All right. Well, thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, substituting for the Atlas Society CEO, Jennifer Grossman. And I'm looking forward to Atlas Society Senior Fellow Robert Trzynski discussing what is human nature. And after Rob offers his view, we're going to open it up to questions on the subject. So feel free to raise your hand and we'll bring you up to be part of the discussion. The session is being recorded for educational purposes. Rob, thanks so much for doing this today. What is human nature?
All right. Well, as usual, I'm glad to be here. So this is a topic I've been mulling over for some time. Human nature is a core concept of philosophy and of all, you know, any moral debates that people have. You have the question of what is human nature, quote unquote, human nature. What does that imply for how we ought to behave and how we can expect people to behave? But I think the concept itself and the idea of what is the concept of human nature is rather somewhat infrequently discussed. And the reason why it's come up to me for a long time, and why I've been wanting to write about this for a while, and I want to talk it through today, is because there's one particular misconception about human nature, or one particular view of human nature that's, I think, is different from the objectivist view that I think is very, very common. I noticed it many years and years ago, and many times since, and it's the assumption that human nature means some kind of inbuilt, hardwired, pre-programmed tendencies. So if you say something is not human nature in this viewpoint, unless we are automatically predisposed to do it. Now, I've noticed this somewhat recently in the, a couple of years ago, there were all these discussions about the legacy of the Enlightenment, and, you know, Steven Pinker had a book and Jonah Goldberg had a book. And one of the themes that tended to come out of that was the idea that reason is unnatural. That a rational and enlightened society is, you know, the problem with it, the reason we have so much trouble maintaining it is because it's unnatural. It goes against human nature. And the idea is that, you know, it goes against the predispositions we have as leftovers from our origins as cavemen. I did a review of Jonah Goldberg's book where I called it, I think the title I used was The Unfrozen Caveman Intellectual. You know, that it's based on a Saturday Night Live skit where they have, it's sort of a takeoff of Matlock or something like that. They have this in Matlock, he always has I'm just an old country lawyer kind of routine. That's, you know, the later Andy Griffith years. And this one is the lawyer is an unfrozen caveman. It's, I'm just an unfrozen caveman. Your modern ways frighten and confuse me. And that's sort of the attitude that we're all unfrozen cavemen. We all have these tendencies and predispositions and cognitive biases that we're susceptible to because of our origins, as these are instincts built into us from when we started out in the caves. And because of that, a tribal, irrational society is the normal and feels normal and comfortable to us, whereas reason is a fragile basis for a society because it's unnatural. Now, you can see how this kind of fits in with, this would come from a conservative writer, and it sort of fits in with a religious outlook and the ideas of original sin. The idea that we are by nature, we are predisposed to act irrationally or to act in a way that is uncivilized. And I noticed this actually popped up a number of years back when I wrote something about the latest pedophile priest scandal that was happening at the time, and just talked about the church being engaged in a war on human nature. What I mean by that is the church's war against sexuality, and how that, you know, in its prohibitions on priests and how that had backfired on them. And I got a Catholic coming back to me and saying, well, of course the church is in a war on human nature, because human nature is this tendency, the susceptibility to sin. You know, human nature is original sin. Human nature is how vicious we are and how we're predisposed to all these irrational behaviors and all these predatory behaviors to each other. So obviously all civilization is a war on human nature, because we're at war against these innate tendencies to act in certain destructive or antisocial ways. All right. I mean, notice how this kind of undercut, even among someone like Jonah Goldberg, who's trying to make a defense of the Enlightenment, it kind of tends to undercut it by saying, well, you know, the rational enlightened society is inherently unnatural. It goes against human nature. And then I noticed it, though, from coming from the other side, that I think Steven Pinker is part of this. And when I was looking into the origins of Quillette, you know, this magazine for heterodox intellectuals, I noticed that there's a lot of it comes from the idea of attacking the idea of a blank slate. Now, the blank slate is the idea that we were born, the Latin term is tabula rasa, that we don't have any innate tendencies or ideas, that everything that humans do is based on every idea we have, every outlook we have, every view of life we have is something we built up through our own thinking. And not, it wasn't pre-programmed into us, and somehow, you know, we don't come with pre-installed software. I guess maybe firmware, would that be the right term? And so this is the idea of and the sort of Steven Pinker and Quillette attack on that is that, you know, it seems like as empiricists they would be in favor of the idea of the tabula rasa, the blank slate. But they were opposed to it, and I figured out what they mean by it. What they mean by it is they said to have a blank slate means that there's a lack of any innate predispositions, which in their view means that humans have no fixed nature and anything goes. You can devise any weird, bizarre social scheme for social improvement or reform of human beings, and human nature, and there's no limit on it because human nature is endlessly malleable. Or in the other version of this, you know, you can be born a man and claim you are a woman because that's how you feel. And there's no way to gainsay that because there's no such thing as human nature. All right, so they took this idea that if human nature means being programmed with innate predispositions to think and act a certain way, then if you say we have a blank slate, then you're saying there is no human nature. Humans are infinitely malleable. Anything goes. And this outlook, by the way, I think very popular today, especially among the sort of evolutionary psychology set. You know, the people who evolutionary psychology is this idea that human psychology can be explained by reference to evolution. And you can come up with stories that attempt to explain various human behaviors by reference to the evolutionary survival value of one behavior versus another, which supposedly led to us to be pre-programmed with various tendencies to think a certain way or act a certain way as survival mechanisms. Now, I think there are various problems with evolutionary psychology, which I would love to get into in the discussion. But it goes back to this idea that reason is unnatural, and anything for which we do not have a everything for which you do not have a clear pre-programmed evolutionary response, which frankly is virtually everything in modern society, is an issue on which there, you know, human nature offers no guidance. So the problem I see with this outlook is it answers the subjective with the subjective. It says there's either arbitrary whim or there's instinct. It answers one kind of rule by feeling with another kind of rule by feeling. Now, you can see the appeal of evolutionary psychology here, though, because it's an attempt to say, well, the rule of the feelings that I'm asking you to follow, the instincts or the pre-programmed responses, well, I can provide a quasi sort of rational basis for those feelings in evolutionary in by describing the evolutionary survival value of this or that. But in actual practice, it means, you know, one kind of feeling is being answered with another. Now, the upshot of all this is that I think objectivism has a very different idea of what human nature is, and I want to briefly spell out what I think that is before we go to the discussion. So what is human nature if we do have a blank slate and we don't have pre-programmed instincts or tendencies? Well, what human nature refers to is it's not if we don't have any pre-programmed tendencies that therefore it's anything goes. What we have are we have the things that we have that are inbuilt and unchangeable parts of human nature is we have certain capacities and certain needs. Now, what I mean by having certain needs is that objective needs, things that require we require whether we want it or not. So the example here would be the need for food, right? You need to eat, you need to fuel your body by the nature of, you know, the physiology, the human physiology, by the nature of a human metabolism. and your need for food is independent of whether or not you have a pre-programmed desire for food. And in fact, you know, you can look at examples of this, that there are people who, we all have the feeling of hunger, but your desire, your need for food is independent of whether you're hungry or not. And there are people whose whose pre-programmed response of hunger is actually miswired in some way. I saw a case a while back about some people who are incapable of satiation. They have like a genetic disorder and they're incapable of feeling full when they eat. So they feel constantly hungry all the time, no matter how much they eat. But clearly how much they food they actually need is independent of that subjective experienced desire. Or, of course, there are people who are taking certain medications, like going through chemotherapy, people will lose their appetite and often experience dangerous and unhealthy levels of weight loss because they don't feel like eating and they eat less. So obviously their need for food is independent of whether or not they feel that need or have an urge to eat. So that's the kind of objective needs I'm talking about that human beings have. The needs for food, for shelter, for clothing, for, you know, being shielded from the elements, etc. Those basic needs and everything that's built on top of that, all of those come from the unchangeable aspects of our nature, the needs of our metabolism, the needs of our the physical needs of our body. And then in terms of capacities, we have a whole bunch of potentialities, a whole bunch of capacities for action that we are equipped with by our nature, so that, you know, we have the capacity to walk because we have muscles of a certain shape and nerve and you know, muscles and nerves are built in such a way that we have the capacity, a normal person has the capacity to walk. And even if you have to learn how to walk, and everybody's had a small child, those, you know, children learn how to walk. They learn how to, they don't have an instinct for it. They're not born, you can compare them to like a young colt that is stands up and walks and gallops around within minutes of being born, versus a human being that takes, you know, 9 months to a year to learn how to do this, programming itself through trial and error. So the idea is we have this capacity, these physical capacities to act and to think, but we have to actuate those capacities tabula rasa, without a pre-program, without inherent programming for it, but simply by programming ourselves through trial and error and learning. So we have the capacity to gain knowledge, but we gain it by going through certain steps. That there are certain steps we have to go through in order to perceive the world and make accurate observations of it, and no other steps. And we have to learn those steps through experience, through trial and error. And that's the reason for our capacity for bias. It's not that we have, or for error. It's not that we have certain inbuilt tendencies toward, you know, pre-programmed tendencies for certain cognitive biases. It's that our capacity for thinking has to be learned. Our knowledge of how to use it does not come automatically one way or the other. And so in the process of learning it, there are certain common errors that people are going to fall into if they don't learn it properly. All right, so I would say we're susceptible to biases rather than prone or have a tendency towards a bias. And one of the ways to look at this is that, you know, the people who say, oh, you know, human nature includes these inherent tendencies, as they'll point out that, well, look, people across the world in different societies all tend to gravitate towards a certain way of doing things. There are certain things that are universal among humans. And you could take that agreement as proof of, oh, well, we all must have a pre-programmed instinct, a language instinct or something like that. Or you could look at it as proof that we all live in the same reality. We're all trying to solve the same basic human problems using the same basic human capacities. And therefore, if we all arrive at very similar solutions, it's because we're all dealing with the same problems. We're all encountering the same reality. We all have the same basic human capacities that we're trying to actualize. I think that now, so that's sort of the objectivist idea of what human nature is compared to the, I think, the very common, especially today, the sort of evolutionary psychology view of human nature as we have a set of inbuilt tendencies or pre-programmed behaviors. And that's what constitutes human nature. And that's what you have to work around in developing morality or in developing a social system. Now, the advantage of, I'm going to talk about all the, you know, we could, in the, I'll open up the discussion. We could talk about what difference these two different views make. But I think that the advantage of the objectivist view of human nature, which is we are tabula rasa, that our nature consists of these capacities that we use to solve these basic human needs, but that we are, everything is learned and invented by us through experience, through trial and error, through choice, is that it lets us be men and not cavemen. And I think it does a much better example of explaining, a much better job of explaining how it is that we rose up into all the unusual and unnatural things that we do in modern society, in a modern, advanced, enlightened society, things that cannot, I think, be explained just by an extension of us acting on whatever was programmed into us by evolution as cavemen, but can actually be explained by us being able to do things being able to program ourselves in using our capacities in response to our basic needs, in response to our encounter with reality, being able to program ourselves and raise ourselves up to much higher levels of survival than would be possible if we were just going on inbuilt pre-programmed responses or tendencies.
That's great. And I want to invite people up from the audience. In preparing for this, I saw the human nature one that you brought up about the priest. And also, you had an article about the future of augmentation, which kind of touched on human nature a little bit. And I'm just curious, is there a point at which technology has an impact on human nature?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I think my theme on the, so I did, this is a piece I did for Real Clear Future, a sort of futurist publication I was doing for the Real Clear group a number of years back. And it was on this idea of what about human augmentation? Because there's a lot of chatter about it right now. It's kind of a bit of a trendy Silicon Valley thing. And, you know, this is like Elon Musk is developing this thing called Neuralink, which some people have a lot of skepticism about, and I think it's probably valid. But this idea that you could put implants in your brain and you could do, you could add on to the capacities of your brain. And I think it's something, so as with a lot of things I wrote for Real Clear Future, that piece was putting a little bit of cold water on those speculations as anything that's going to happen anytime soon. So that, you know, because a lot of that is, you know, people getting caught away from themselves with this idea that, oh, we're going to, you know, in 5 years, we're going to put these implants in our brain and expand our capacity for memory and expand our capacity for this. It's not going to happen in 5 or 10 years. I think it will eventually happen, and that will raise the question of how does human nature change? What are the requirements change? I don't think human nature will change fundamentally, but I think that what will happen is we will grow and augment in power. And partly that article is my answer to the robot apocalypse people. Because, you know, I was doing this publication dealing with emerging technology and future technology. And when you do that, it's really like a whole series of people coming up with ideas for how human beings are going to be destroyed by technology, right? So one of them is the robot apocalypse, and they're going to come along, and the robots are going to get, they're going to have artificial intelligence, and the robots are going to get smarter than us and stronger than us, and then we're all going to be doomed. And if we're lucky, they'll keep us as pets. And one of the things I pointed out is that if human augmentation is eventually possible, what we will do is that as we develop these technologies to make more and more powerful brains and things like that, we won't just let the robots have it. We'll plug ourselves into it and we'll create that augmented intelligence for ourselves. But I think that's all going to have to be built onto and grafted onto how human beings, you know, the capacities were given by nature and how human beings work now. So I'm skeptical that that will ever lead to a fundamental change in what human nature is. It will lead to an augmentation in the power and range of what we already have.
That's great. David, did you have anything?
I've got a very ideas here, but Rob has already hit on most of them. So I'm going to hold off for now. Thank you. And follow the discussion. Thanks.
All right, good. Well, you know, I have this Rand quote of, you know, the key to what you so recklessly call human nature, the open secret you live with yet dread to name, is the fact that man is a being of volitional consciousness. Man has no automatic code for survival. And I'm curious how you kind of integrate that into your view.
Okay, so that's what I mean with the idea that, you know, the advantage of this outlook on human nature is it allows us to live as men and not cavemen. So in the, I don't think it was part of the piece on human augmentation I did, but elsewhere I came across some interesting speculation of people saying, somebody saying human beings are already augmented in the sense that the way our brain, the theory here was that the way our brains work has already been changed, not by some futuristic technology, but by our cultural achievements, but by, you know, so that the various ideas that we've developed and practices we've developed as a civilized society actually alter the way the human brain works and make it possible to do more and accomplish more, like language, for example, you know, the use of language. I'm trying to remember what the examples were, but I think the language is the primary one, that it actually changes the way memory works and basically increases the capacity of our brain, that we've already altered the way our brain works by the cultural software that we pass down, you know, from generation to generation, by loading this cultural software and teaching our children about this way of thinking and ways of acting, that we actually have already augmented the capacity of our brains and changed the way our brains work relative to the way they worked beforehand. And so that's the thing that I think is really powerful, is that one idea I've been toying around with a lot recently in the last few years is the crucial role that volition has in conceptual thinking. That the fact that we are able to, we're not programmed, but we are capable of programming ourselves, that we're a self-programming a creature that's capable of self-programming, that's the role, the central role that volition has in our consciousness, that it's what volition is what gives us the ability to be self-programming, and that's what allows us to augment our capacities so far beyond what we're given by nature. And so I think that's part of what Ayn Rand is getting at there, is that self-programming ability, that we're not just pushed around by whatever programming was loaded into us by the factory when we were cavemen, but that we can reprogram we can program ourselves to engage in terms of our behavior, in terms of our thinking methods, and then in that way we go beyond, far beyond what was given to us just by habit or by imitation or by nature.
Scott, if I could jump in with a couple of examples that I think relate to what Rob is saying about augmentation. One is that a lot of the augmentation has to do with enhancing our sense of faculties of perception. Glasses to correct visual problems are centuries old. That's a piece of technology we take it for granted now, but it's a piece of technology that corrected for an inborn deficit that some people have. Similarly, there's been a lot of work with blind people in trying to invent ways to give them the experience of the world around them through the touch modality, with sensors that provide the equivalent of a visual grid. There's a lot of those things around. There's an entire field called embodied cognition, the whole, you know, approach to of it. And it includes everything from note-taking. It externalizes ideas so we can remember them more easily. The technology that we're using right now, we didn't have 30 years ago, where we can communicate and talk to each other without leaving our homes. But there's also the cultural evolution that Rob was talking about. My favorite example is numbers. We all think in Arabic numerals now, including the number zero, which took centuries for people to understand what zero was. It didn't seem like a quantity. So finally, we have a system of numbers. We all learn it in grade school, adding, subtracting. Think about trying to do that with Roman numerals or with, you know, counting, you know, an abacus or something. And whether or not that has affected the brain, it has certainly become automatic on our parts, but it was a human invention. And the capacity for it may have been inbuilt, but it was discovered and then applied by all of us. So, you know, I think the distinction between what's the capacities that are inbuilt in human nature and the content, including the many of the, not just, you know, subject knowledge, but many of the techniques and methods of thinking are, we have through invention, but the inventions occurred because we had the inborn capacity to discover and produce. So thanks, Rob. That's
Well, here's another example. My favorite examples in this sort of thing is, this is from a professor I had in college who was teaching ancient Greek. And he talked about how the earliest Greek writings, there's a change in ancient Greek writings, that before a certain period, the sorts of things that he said that before a certain period, writing is treated sort of like a musical score. It's there sort of more as a note to a performer. So, you know, the primary method of communicating was oral. You would speak something aloud to a group of people, and the text was there as sort of the score to be performed by the performer. And so things that you would do in speech, like contractions, were never included in the writing. And then there's a certain point at which suddenly contractions and the things that you would do when actually speaking the words are put in the writing, and where people begin to treat writing as something that talks to them directly. So the experience you and I, that's just totally normal for a modern civilized person, where you sit down, you know, in a literate society, you sit down and you read a book, and when your experience of the book is the author is speaking to you directly. His point was that was not how writing was used until this very distinct period about 2000, you know, a little over 2000 years ago, where you see it happening in the way people are writing, that they write in a more conversational style, as if the book itself is supposed to be speaking to you. And just imagine how that changes the amount of information you can take in. And, you know, it reprograms your brain to be able to take in this enormous amount of information from other people in a method that is different from and faster and more widely accessible than having to talk to a person, you know, using, you know, through speech. So it's another way in which our way of thinking about the world, that our way of taking on information gets programmed by us and programmed in programmed in new ways. So it's not just, you know, language doesn't mean, oh, we can talk to each other using speech. Language eventually means I can sit down and read a book and absorb this enormous amount of information from somebody who died thousands of years ago without any intermediary intermediary person through which I'm getting it. I'm getting it directly from a long dead author.
Good stuff. Lawrence?
Hello. Can you all hear me pretty good?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, Robert, great subject. And I think you've touched upon this in your explanation, just to sort of pull it out, because, you know, people, when you talk about that more, that blank slate, the sort of tabula rasa, a lot of people, they don't find that satisfying. They make the argument, well, oh, well, then that means humans have the capacity to do all sorts of terrible things. They're just going to be, you know, you'll often hear the term, they're just a product of their environment, which means they could be doing great good or great evil, and they don't find that truly satisfying. Now, we talked about here about, you know, the aspect of reason that is also at play here, and that is learning and testing. But to talk to the, to sort of answer that specific thing about these people who say that isn't everything inherently productive environment, there is no morality or subjective, trying to, could you maybe try to really hammer home the counter to sort of that mindset?
Right, so that sort of evolutionary psychology, or you know, we have inherent inbuilt desires or tendencies, that viewpoint, I think, is almost like it's an attempt to answer subjectivist arguments without really exiting fully from the subjectivist outlook, right? So it's because the subjectivist outlook is we are pushed around by whatever feelings we happen to have, and there. So I think the idea is that the people who, the evolutionary psychology types, want to guard against or fight back against the idea that, oh, everything's all just socially subjective, and that's sort of the standard viewpoint of sort of the woke left today, which is everything is socially constructed. And so, you know, concepts of gender are just socially constructed. So if they're socially constructed, they can be socially reconstructed. And everything, you know, every idea we have about how, well, human behavior, about what's right and wrong, it can be endlessly malleably changed. And this really goes back to the history of this on the political left, goes back to the idea under Marxism that if you just change people's environment, if you change the human environment, if you reprogram the way society is constructed, that human beings will be constructed differently. They'll have different values and different actions. And that's what will make socialism work. And this is the idea of the new Soviet man, right? If you just reconstruct every aspect of society, you can stamp out individualism and people will act on the collective good with no concern for their individual well-being, because they will have been programmed that way by the social environment in which they're raised. And of course that's not how it works. It didn't happen. And so the attempt to say, oh, well, it's because we're inherently self-interested, or we're inherently selfish, or there are certain inherent tendencies that we have that are part of human, quote unquote, human nature, this sort of somewhat determinist view of human nature that by genetics or by evolutionary programming or what have you, we behave a certain way. That was almost like an attempt to answer that socially subjective view of things, in which we could endlessly be reprogrammed by the rulers and controllers of society. But they did it without really fundamentally exiting the subjectivist perspective, in which what really matters are, well, how do you feel? What are your urges? What are your desires? Rather than the idea that human nature comes from the things that we are metaphysically given apart from consciousness, that is apart from the subjective inner experience of consciousness. You know, there's how our consciousness is constituted in terms of, you know, how our brains are structured and how our faculty of perception works. But you know, it's not just how you feel or your internal subjective experience of consciousness. That's how your consciousness is constituted based on its physical nature. So it's the idea that, you know, what's given to us metaphysically by nature and our encounter with that metaphysical reality, that's the source on which we learn and program ourselves on the basis of that learning and trial and error. And that's what yields, that's where human nature comes from. So that's a fully objective, fully non-subjective conception of human nature, where it's not just, well, you think we're programmed with certain feelings by our environment, and I think we're programmed with certain feelings by our heredity, and throwing out the idea that, no, it's not about your feelings determining reality. It's about reality giving you certain capacities, and your encounter with the physics of the world around you, and then you programming yourself and programming your consciousness in relation to that reality.
Thanks. Great. JP, do you have something?
Yeah, thank you, Scott. I guess I ponder a lot lately, especially in the last few years, as to what the split is in human nature between virtue and vice, good and evil, good and bad. And that's what I use my yin yang symbol here for my PTR. And lately I've been, if I understood objectivism right, we as a civilization have started to not conduct ourselves with the appropriate code of ethics, and hence in for example from Ayn Rand's novels you would probably deduct that she had a grim view of humanity, and she was sounding the bell, and that's pretty much something that we sort of agree. And so I was of the belief that we were mostly good, and lately I've been thinking that's exactly half. If you're a good person, you will be hated by exactly half of humanity, and vice versa.
Well, my version of the yin yang here would be, we have the capacity to do either, and that's just the key to human nature, is the capacity of choice. Humans have the capacity to do either. But the other part of it I would put into it is that I think one of the fundamental aspects of this perspective on human nature is everything has to be learned. Nothing's programmed in. Everything has to be learned. And when everything has to be learned, there's always the possibility of not learning it or getting it wrong or making a mistake. And, either as an individual or as a culture. A culture can, in struggling to get a group of people all working together in a culture, trying to get their minds around certain basic concepts of how to live human life, they can make mistakes. They can make errors in how, or come to, they can come to an understanding that's valid, but doesn't quite, but not exact enough, or make some small error within the process of having learned something valid. They make some small error over there. I think, for example, we had a discussion about this the other day where we were talking about I think also in a clubhouse, we were talking about some concept like this where, I think it was an enlightened self-interest. That was it, enlightened self-interest. And talking about all the confusions historically that have come up with the concept of self-interest and self-sacrifice, and how do you account for the role of self-interest in a society. And I was saying that, this is it's a fundamental concept of how you organize a society. What's the relationship between the self and others, between the individual and the tribe, that you would expect that throughout history, there people are going to come up with all sorts of misconceptions or wrong versions of the concept as they're dealing with it for the first time. That, if you have to learn everything, you have to develop these ideas from the ground up, you are naturally going to not get it right immediately. And you're going to come up with approximations or things that are not quite exact. And, I think that's an interesting way of looking at human history and intellect, and especially the history of ideas, the history of philosophy, is that it's the idea that we have certain capacities and certain needs, and we're trying to program ourselves with the ideas that will help to capture what our capacities are and how we use them to address our needs. And in doing that, we're going to, we're going to make progress, but then make mistakes, make incomplete progress over here, and make disastrous errors over there. and then working out those errors and correcting them. You know, so for example, if you have this, in I think in the 19th century, we made a big vast detour towards the idea of collectivism, that, oh, well, you know, we don't need the individual and the individual thought and effort. If we all just had everybody working together as a collective and renouncing their own good, then we could have an ideal society. And then over a period of 150 years or so, that was rigorously tried over and over again on an increasingly large scale, and then led to it led to increasingly larger disasters with, you know, the Soviet Union and fascism and communism and all of that. And that was a process. You can sort of view that history as a process of human beings trying out a wrong idea and hopefully figuring out, we're still not quite there, that it was wrong, and then trying to figure out why it was wrong. And so, you know, and of course, if we don't figure out why it's wrong, we have faced the danger of repeating the experiment again with equally disastrous results. So I think that that's sort of the capacity for good and evil comes from the fact that we have to learn everything. We have to create everything. We have to do it through choosing our own actions. So the capacity for getting it right and getting it wrong, or for, you know, building up knowledge or undermining knowledge, that capacity is there at every moment in every human being. And that's the sort of the balance of good and evil. That's my perspective on how you talk about the balance between good and evil and human nature.
You know, what you said about socialism, and it's mm-hmm. one of those things we tease them about, that, you know, oh, you think it's going to work this time. What we're really saying is that it's not working because it's going against human nature.
Yeah, and I think that I think it also explains why they want it so badly to work. I mean, there are very few ideas that people have been as resistant to learning as the failure of socialism or the failure of communism. And they will just dig in and find any excuse they can find not to have to. You know, you can have a century and a half of history of this thing idea failing over and over and over again, and people will dig in deep to avoid. I mean, the New York Times a couple of years ago, in 2017, I think it was, the 100th anniversary. The New York Times, quote unquote, celebrated. I think that's the word you have to use. They celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution by having this whole series of articles assessing the legacy of communism. And what was notable about it is how many of the articles were basically about how good the legacy of communism was. And somebody talking about, oh, women were liberated and all these, and what the tremendous idealism of that the communists brought, that was the wonderful thing about them, was how idealistic they were. And he's like, was that before or after they were putting people in the gulags? And this tremendous resistance people had to learning even the most basic lessons of history. And it's because this all has to be learned, and you have to develop the discipline. You know, part of this, one of these pieces of cultural software that we have that helps us to augment and make our brains work better, is this idea of developing the discipline of identifying and identifying your own biases, your own desires and wishes, and keeping in your mind the idea that just because I want something to be true doesn't mean it's true, that I have to be open to evidence to the contrary. And, you know, not enough people have absorbed that particular discipline. Here's another, by the way, we're talking about this programming, how we program our consciousness to make it work better. One great example of a theory that I found very intriguing on that was somebody's pointing out that, you know, if you go back to all these ancient stories, the most ancient stories from the world, you know, ancient Greek myths and things like that, one of the common tropes in them is that, you know, Odysseus is trying to figure out what to do while he's traveling back from Troy. And a god comes to him and tells him to do something. And prompted by what the god tells him to do, he then goes out and does something, and it's successful. And the speculation somebody came up with, which I think is really intriguing, and I think there's something to it, is that that's how people processed it, you know, in an early period when they weren't good at introspection and good, they weren't good at figuring out this idea I had, where did it come from? A new idea would just seem like, when you think about it, you know, if you've ever been solving a problem, an idea suddenly pops into your head. And with your outlook, you have the idea that, oh, well, the idea popped in my head because my subconscious was feeding it to me. But if you didn't have this idea of, oh, my subconscious was feeding it to me, you might think, an idea popped in my head. Where did it come from? Maybe this was the voice of a god prompting me. And that's why this is so common in like, you know, literature from thousands of years ago, this idea of a god coming to speak to somebody, that that was how people conceived of the ideas popping into their own minds. And, you know, it's much more powerful, of course, if you understand, no, that's not a god speaking to me. That's, you know, that's my own consciousness working through ideas and making connections on it and feeding those to me through my subconscious. That gives you much more control over how your brain works and much more control over your process of thought and a much better ability to double check and to adjust your method of thinking, rather than that sort of, you know, every new idea that pops into my head is the prompting of some spirit or demon or God.
That's good. Thank you for indulging me, Felipe. Do you have something? Felipe? I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Making me discover this club. I got late in the room, so apologies if the topic was covered. I'm still new to Ayn Rand's works and philosophy, so I'd like to throw a question for, you know, an open question to the room, and which is, what did she have to say about the creative impulse of the human nature and its place in society at large, I would guess?
Okay, the creative impulse. Well, I think the really powerful thing about Ayn Rand is that she, I think ultimately, now I don't know if she ever addressed it in quite these terms, but I think ultimately that the power of her ideas is she did not see the creative impulse as being separate from or from the basics of the job of living. You know, the job of living as a human being is you are constantly learning and trying to understand the world around you and then trying to reshape the world around you to better fit your needs, you know, to, you know, whether the need is to plant crops so you can eat or the need is to produce steel so you can make tools, whatever the needs are, you're trying to learn how do things work? How does the world work? How do you know, what's the physical nature of things around me and how can I rearrange those things? How can I change them? What processes do I have to go through to make steel or to make a better steel? And that this is the central activity of human life, right? Is trying to understand things and then understand how you can change and rearrange them and how you can come up with new ways of doing things to do them better. And that is the creative impulse. Right now, you can talk about the creative impulse in terms of art or ideas or imagination, but really, all of that creative impulse is really just those. That's a subset, a particular kind of application of this wider creative impulse, which is the essence of human activity, the essence of human life, is trying to understand how things work around you, and then understanding how you can change your actions, how you can do new things to rearrange the world to make it better suit your needs. So, and that, I think, and that's a crucial theme of her novels. If you look at it now, Atlas Shrugged, it comes out a lot, but I think even it comes out in I'm rereading The Fountainhead recently, and I think it comes out a lot there, is the idea that, you know, invent what you do to make steel is not a fundamentally different creative process than what you do to make a symphony, that it is, you know, that the creative impulse is the essential human activity of trying to support our lives by understanding the world around us and rearranging it to suit our needs.
Scott, if I could jump in with another thought on this point in answer to Philippe. And it goes deep into the objectivist epistemology, the view of knowledge that Rand developed. And it's this: every other species of animal that we have studied or know anything about has certain cognitive capacities, but those capacities are limited to responding to, perceiving, and dealing with a specific domain in their environment. Humans, as conceptual beings, our domain is reality. The ability to think conceptually means that nothing is inevitably or inherently beyond our range. We're always limited at a given time in our knowledge, and in a given any individual is of course limited in what that individual knows. But there is no unknowable, and part of that is the ability to ask the question, what if. Rand made a point of that in writing about her creative process as a fiction writer. What if, that's an interesting, that would be really interesting. What if there was a character who was a crook and a really devious fraud, but he was a hero? What if? And then she wrote Night of January 16th. The same process, the ability to imagine possibilities beyond what we're directly aware of or beyond what we know already, is built into the conceptual faculty. And it's essential, as Rob was saying, to technological invention, manufacture, and all the inventions that have changed us, changed the world we live in from the world of cavemen. From skyscrapers to computers to medicine, everything else, it was always someone asking, what if, and then saying, okay, let me check it out.
Now, I want to ask Philippe if this is answering what you, the direction you want. This is what I missed. I can't see people. Light bulbs going for scrunching your forehead because the
answer will be mine. Getting a little warble.
From me?
Yes.
Is it better now?
Yes.
Okay. But if in the absence of response, one of the aspects too, also the creative power that I wanted to talk about is, I said we have certain capacities that are given to us by nature. And one of those capacities is this ability to think conceptually, to have a very complex consciousness. And the interesting thing about that is that, as I said, fundamentally, we're driven by our physical needs, food, clothing, and shelter. The other aspect of our creative or imaginative or artistic life is that we answer these basic physical needs by using this conceptual consciousness, which is an extremely complex and abstract and how would you put it? It's a way of thinking that has tremendous psychological demands. And as a result of that, we also then, on top of the physical needs, we have a whole bunch of needs that come up that are needs of that complex conceptual consciousness. And that's what gives rise to our need for companionship, or our need for art, or our need, or our need of epistemology or philosophy, or some overarching explanation to explain to us how the world works and how our consciousness works. So we have all these. I think what people tend to think of as the creative aspect of life. That by that they tend to mean. They tend to mean things that address these psychological needs of our consciousness, things like art and love and imagination and entertainment and recreation. They think of all those things, but those are things that are, so there's like the primary needs that are the physical needs of survival, food, clothing, and shelter. But then because our way of solving those needs is this amazing tool, this amazing capacity we have, of extremely complex conceptual consciousness, that gives rise to this whole secondary set of needs on top of that, which is the psychological needs of things that we need to keep that consciousness functioning properly, or to make it function even better. And that's what gives rise, you know, from the very beginnings, you know, one of the earliest things human beings, modern humans do is they're making paintings on cave walls. So we, you know, those are very clearly the things that mark us off from the pre-humans that came before us, is we start engaging in things like rituals and using art and start to develop the first sort of wider concepts and religious beliefs, very early religious beliefs. And so that's the other thing that marks us off, as the kind of consciousness we have gives us tremendous power, but then it creates all these needs of its own, and we develop ways of addressing those needs, such as art and religion and music and what have you.
Well, I'm sorry, Scott. I just wanted to add that, apologies. I should have been more precise, because indeed I was referring more to the artistic expression of yeah, you know, creativity. But I think that Rob and David sort of rounded up pretty nicely. And I would assume that an entire hour could be dedicated to that topic as well.
That's what I was going to say. William, do you have a quick one you can squeeze in?
I don't know if it'll be quick, but I'll try. Thank you, Rob, for your presentation. I have a question about the development of human nature. Mm-hmm. I know, so there are stages of a human's life, when you're born, and then when you go through puberty and become mature. So I see at least two or three stages of life. And in the initial stage, you're born with primitive reflexes. So while I agree that we're not born with inherent or intrinsic ideas, I think we do come into this world with reflexes, which allow mm-hmm. us to have automatic responses to stimuli. And I was wondering, how do you think that impacts the development of our faculties such as reason?
Yeah, I think we have to be born with some very, very basic reflexes, because otherwise you wouldn't survive. Like the first reflex an infant has is the sucking reflex, right? It wants to suck on something because that's how it gets food. But although the interesting thing about that, though, is we have way fewer of those than any of the other animals. And I think it's been fairly well demonstrated that basically what happened is we are because of how humans evolved, we are born 9 months too early. That is, you know, compared to other animals, we should have another 9 months in the womb to help develop all of our capacities. And there are different speculations about why it is we don't have that. And one of them is, well, our heads, you know, as we got larger brains, our heads got too big. And if we stayed long enough to develop our brains to the point where we had all these capacities, we'd never fit out. You know, we'd never make it out. But it also has to do with the fact that not being as pre-programmed, not having as many reflexes. So, you know, think of a horse, a newborn horse. We've all seen footage of this, or if you grew up on a farm, you've seen it in real life. A newborn horse or a cow coming out, and it stands up immediately. You know, human beings can't do that. So part of it is that we have these big heads that won't fit through if we let them grow for another 9 months. But part of it is also that the huge advantage we get, and here's where I will cite evolution, the huge evolutionary survival advantage we get from having fewer software pre-programmed into us, and more ability to and a much, much vaster ability that virtually everything we do is programmed into ourselves. That produces such a huge advantage that evolution said, okay, I'm going to produce this infant that can do virtually nothing except maybe suck on a nipple once it comes out of the womb, and it's going to have to develop everything else. But the trade-off for that is, because it has to develop and learn everything else, then it can do so much more, you know, when it reaches adulthood. And so I think, yeah, we come with some very, very basic reflexes, but I think my view is that by evolutionary design, is that in effect, and I know evolutionary design is one of these sort of paradoxical formulations, but by the way that we evolved, we come out with fewer reflexes and fewer inbuilt reactions, precisely because of the huge advantage that comes from having to program most of it for ourselves.
Great. Yeah. Well, William, I thank you. We're not going to have time for Mark's question either. We're at the top of the hour, but this was a great subject. We touched on a lot of great things. I just wanted to say real quickly, tomorrow, Ayn Rand's birthday, Atlas Society is having three big events. The Atlas Society asks Ashley Reinsberg at 3 p.m. Then here on Clubhouse, Stephen Hicks at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, Ask Me Anything About Ethics. And then my favorite at 7:30 via Zoom, they're doing an Ayn Rand's birthday celebration with scholars and people from the Atlas Society. And can be found on atlassociety.org. But thank you, everyone, for joining us today. And we look forward to everything tomorrow. Jennifer?
Just saying, great job. You're hired.
You're kind. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I would say thanks, Scott, for taking the reins today.
Absolutely. You were great.